we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning. I always wondered how that song ended.
Actually, it fires back up again a little bit, so I can bring it back up for you if you like.
No, that's okay. That's all right. We don't mind.
All right. So plenty to cover this week, starting with local, and some records are being set.
Yeah, a couple of records set this week last week in two of the political campaigns this year in terms of money being spent. First off, the mayor of Seattle, the race for the mayor, has they've collected and spent most of $2.6 million, and the amounts are growing each day. Most of it has been collected by the candidate's own official campaigns. The Murray campaign has collected about $722,000 as of Thursday. It's much more than that now. McGinn's collected about $448,000, probably closer to $500,000 as of today. These are record amounts, particularly amounts collected by political action committees. Those are private groups that are running campaigns or running ads on behalf of the candidates, and they can, unlike the candidates' campaigns, which are limited to $700 per donee, the political action committees can collect unlimited amounts from each donee. Their amounts total about $500,000 so far. Both Murray and McGinn have PACs collecting money and running ads on their behalf, and they're about even. Murray's maybe collected a little bit more than McGinn's.
And these are the ads you see that are sort of like, you know, Americans against portly mayors or Americans who want to see a gay mayor or whatever. You don't know who they are. You don't know who the trade groups are behind them. And, you know, if you really dig through the public records, you can probably find out, but who does
it's
that?
It's not obvious when you're seeing
exactly.
The ads. Now, Murray's got a couple of big PACs going on his side. He has People for Ed Murray, which is mostly business groups, have collected around $127,000 and are running advertising for him. And then he also has People for a New Seattle Mayor, which is basically police and firefighters being advised by Tim Sice. They've collected about $95,000 to $100,000.
I love how People for Ed Murray are corporations.
Yeah, I know.
Because corporations are people too, my friend.
Oh, yes, they are. And then on McGinn's side, he's got a couple of PACs. They're labor unions. One is Unite Here Local 8 has so far spent about $100,000 for mailers on his behalf. And Unite Here Local 8 is mostly hotel workers, the hotel workers unions.
Yeah, hotel and restaurant employees.
Working Families for Mayor McGinn, that's mostly the grocery workers union, UFCW Local 21, they've spent about $120,000.
And if people remember the money from the UFCW campaign was a direct result of that gesture that McGinn did in August for around Whole Foods.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a political stunt. But at the same time, it was a very profitable political stunt for the McGinn campaign.
Yeah. And so that's where most of the money has been going in the mayor's race. But there were other amounts raised by the seven other candidates who were eliminated in the primaries, including about $250,000 collected by Tim Burgess, who actually dropped out of the race, didn't even make it to the primary. So that's also added in to that almost $2.7 million. Now the other campaign that's been collecting record amounts is the anti-I-522 campaign. That's the GMO labeling initiative. That anti-I-522 campaign has collected a total of $22 million, a record amount being spent to either support or defeat an initiative in the state of Washington. 11 million of that, approximately half, is from the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which has collected money on behalf of corporations like ConAgra, Del Monte, General Mills, Kellogg, Coke, Pepsi, and Nestle, and a whole host of other big food and agriculture companies to spend in that race to try to defeat the labeling of genetically modified organisms. And of course, this week, another huge donation came into the anti-I-522 campaign from Monsanto, who threw in another $540,000, bringing their total to $5.4 million to try to defeat this initiative. DuPont Pioneer has spent about $3.9 million. And then the other three big donors, individual donors to that campaign are Bayer Crop Science, Dow AgriScience, and BASF, which is have each spent about $500,000 or a little more to try to defeat I-522. The pro side, the folks supporting the GMO labeling initiative, have collected about a quarter of that.
Yeah, and the record that it broke was actually from the liquor privatization initiative last year, which
Costco.
Was the Costco initiative. So it tells you where these massive amounts of money are coming from. They're coming from big corporations who actually have more rights than most people do because they have more money.
And as the media has said, both sides of the I-522 campaigns, the anti and the pro, have been predominantly collecting money from out of state, although the people who are for labeling genetically modified organisms have been collecting more money in state than the anti side.
Yes, and some pigs are more equal than others.
Yes.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Study out on why men run for office more than women.
Yeah, you may have noticed that both mayoral candidates are men. The mayoral primary was dominated by men. It was like the first five, or if you count Burgess, six candidates. Actually, it was the top six finished, including Doug McQuaid, who hardly ran a campaign. The city council races, six of the eight are men. And we see this pattern replicating in the early 90s. Washington had the highest percentage of women legislators in Olympia of any state. Because no other states have legislators in Olympia, but you know what I mean. It was about 40%, and that figure has actually dropped by 10% over the past 20 years. And so the National Women's Political Caucus of Washington did a survey to ask why. And the result, speaking generally, is they went around and interviewed candidates and prospective candidates about their decisions to run and why they ran and why they decided not to run. And what it roughly boils down to, even in a state with two women senators and a recent two-term woman governor, is that men will put themselves forward to run. Women wait for other people to ask them. And it's and that sort of self-selection out of the political gene pool, as it were, in many cases, men have access to greater financial resources because of the disparity between men and women in terms of income and gender pay equity and that sort of thing. It's a reflection of the larger society, but it's also a reflection of a failure by political parties, by a political establishment to be actively encouraging people to step forward. Because when that happens, there is a gender bias in terms of the types of people who do step forward. There's also a strong bias toward narcissists of both genders, but that's a different issue.
Well, yeah, and a lot of times, speaking as a woman, a lot of times if you do push yourself forward, that's not considered attractive in a woman. Women are often castigated. They're called the B-I-T, you know, word, and they're often
bitter.
No, not bitter. And they're often kind of pushed down in that way. And so a lot of women see that. Women who are not necessarily go-getters in the first place see that, and they don't want to be labeled that, and they say, well, no, I will wait till someone asks me. But men don't do that. Men are often rewarded for pushing themselves forward.
Yes, it matters mm-hmm. more with women than men whether they are attractive. Just look at our mayoral candidates.
Yeah, uh-huh.
All right. Moving on, West Coast governors and British Columbia meeting this last week.
Yeah, on Monday, three West Coast governors plus the premier of British Columbia got together and signed the Pacific Coast Action Plan on Climate and Energy. This is often referred to as the West Coast Climate Action Plan. It's to promote clean energy and address climate change through the regional perspective. California and B.C., as part of this plan, will continue their current carbon pricing programs and their current fuel standard programs. Washington and Oregon don't have those in place, so it'll be incumbent upon their legislatures to pass laws that are similar. That's the plan. Governor Inslee right now has a task force drafting some policies and I'm hoping to come up with a carbon pricing law that the legislature can look at, hopefully in the next year or two. The question is, however, whether our state legislature is ready to pass something like that, particularly when we had a Senate in this past legislative session that had two or three turncoat Democrats who sided with the Republicans and made it very, very difficult to even pass a state budget, much less a transportation budget or other priorities of a Democratic governor, including a climate action plan. Meanwhile, Governor Inslee has been picked to join President Obama's climate task force, which is going to be giving the president some advice on national policy as well as how the federal government can support local governments in their efforts to address climate change.
And remember that when Inslee was in Congress, he was chair of a House Energy Committee. So he has done quite a bit of work on that.
So he has quite a bit of background on this. But it's one thing to have a governor who's willing to do this. It's another thing to have a state legislature that's willing to back him up.
Yeah. And Oregon has the same problem that Washington does of Republicans who are willing to obstruct this kind of stuff.
So, yeah.
And in the case of Olympia, it's almost certainly going to not change for the 2013-2014 biennium. You're still going to have the Republican quasi-caucus in charge.
In the Senate.
All right. Moving on, the Thurston County judge.
Yeah, the Commission on... it's morning. The Commission on Judicial Conduct gave Thurston County Judge Jerry Tabor a formal reprimand this week, an admonition for saying that he was, quote, uncomfortable marrying same-sex couples and wanted such requests transferred to another judge's office. Now, Tabor told the Judicial Conduct Commission that he felt like he wasn't doing anything wrong since judges don't have a legal responsibility in Washington State to perform marriages, so being a bigot is okay as long as enforcing the law is optional. That didn't really fly as a defense with the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Uncomfortable kind of reminds me of an old ACT UP chant, "We're here, we're queer, get used to it." So maybe if the good judge doesn't want to catch up to the 21st century, he could at least make it to the 1980s.
All right. Moving yes. on to national and food stamp benefits.
Yeah, the SNAP program, that's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is what they call food stamps formally these days, goes out to roughly 48 million Americans, and there was a big bump in food stamp assistance in 2009 as part of Obama's initial stimulus package when he came in. It was the most effective parts of the stimulus package because, unlike, say, money being given to banks, it goes back immediately into the economy. And there was an enormous need for it as well. As I say, 48 million people. But that is being cut back to pre-2009 levels as of the first of this month, that is yesterday, meaning cutbacks for pretty much everybody on food stamps. And the reason for that is fairly simple. Republicans in Congress won't permit an extension. In fact, the House, which is controlled by Republicans, sent to the Senate a budget proposal that included dramatic cutbacks for the food stamp program. That was one reason they couldn't pass a farm bill. Food stamps come under the Agriculture Department, so it's considered part of the farm bill.
Part of the Republican war on the poor.
Very much so. And I'll get to that in a minute. But in particular, something like one out of every four children in the country today are in households that participate in the food stamp program. Two-thirds of the households that get food stamps have kids in them. So you have Republicans literally taking food out of the mouths of kids. It's a new phenomenon because historically Republicans have believed in some social safety net, even if they thought churches and charities should provide it rather than government. Now you have this ethic that being poor or hungry is a moral failing, even if you're a child, and therefore you should starve to death for your failings. And it's a pretty frightening development, actually. In the 1850s, when the Whig Party broke into two over the question of slavery, the pro-slavery portion of the Whigs called itself the Know-Nothings. It may be a kind of similar truth in a labeling spirit. Can we call the pro-hate, anti-humanity Tea Party types the Malevolent Party? Because that's really what it's boiling down to.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on, a couple lawsuits this week regarding abortion rights.
Yeah, one in Texas and one in Oklahoma. The Texas lawsuit, a U.S. district court in Austin, blocked a portion of the state's new restrictive anti-abortion law. That's the law that Wendy Davis spent time in the state legislature filibustering. She is now running for governor of Texas. They blocked the part of the anti-abortion law that requires doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, only to have that stay on the law overturned 3 days later by the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court in New Orleans, which put the law into effect. Now, about a third of Texas's reproductive health clinics will have to stop providing abortion under this law. Now, I just want to point out for folks who are not familiar with abortion doctors, they're much, much more rare these days than they used to be, partly because of the Republican rights war against abortion. Doctors who do perform abortions often travel between multiple clinics over a large region. So requiring them to have admitting privileges in a large number of local hospitals is just completely unrealistic. Also, it's also completely unnecessary. Serious complications from abortion are very, very rare. And when a patient does have a serious complication, they are often transported to a local hospital where they will be treated regardless of whether or not the doctor who initially performed the abortion has admitting privileges. Hospitals don't turn away patients. So that requirement is completely unnecessary under the law. Now, the lawsuit itself didn't challenge a couple of other egregious portions of the Texas anti-abortion law. It didn't challenge the ban on abortions after 20 weeks after conception. That's a law that's been passed in a number of states that have been challenged elsewhere and has been stayed in other states. It also didn't challenge the law's mandate that doctors use an outdated FDA protocol, which was set back in the 1990s, on how to administer RU486 and other medical non-surgical abortion drugs. That outdated protocol says that they can only administer the drugs through the seventh week of pregnancy instead of 9 weeks, which is the current practice, and it specifies a higher dose, which is much harder on a woman's body. Now, courts in three states have blocked the 20-week ban. And Oklahoma this week, the Oklahoma Supreme Court ruled that the outdated FDA protocol on RU486 and similar drugs is unconstitutional, that it, quote, restricts the long-respected medical discretion of physicians, end quote. Yeah, I kind of wish other courts would listen to physicians in these cases. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that it has already put the Oklahoma case on its docket, so it will decide in the RU486 and other medication type abortions issue. Groups in Texas, the groups suing in Texas, the ACLU, Planned Parenthood of Greater Texas, and the Center for Reproductive Rights will probably appeal the decision on the Texas law to the Supreme Court as well.
Yeah, and by the way, the requirement for admitting privileges was what was used in Mississippi to eliminate the last remaining abortion clinic there. That also was upheld by the same Fifth Circuit conservative judges.
Extremely conservative circuit court.
Speaking of which, I know we're jumping, but this is related. We had in the alternate universe, speaking of conservative judges, Huffington Post reporting on the current Republican refusal in the Senate to allow the filling of three vacant seats in the critical D.C. District Court, which hears a lot of federal lawsuits at the district level. The Republican claim is that the district doesn't need that many judges, even though existing law requires it. Huffington Post was interviewing Alabama Republican Jefferson Beauregard, Sessions III, about Chief Justice John Roberts' support for filling those positions because he says the judicial system needed them. Sessions complained that Roberts wasn't, quote, a real Republican. Those are his words. And, quote, he's always advocating for the court. He wants pay raises for staff. Otherwise, he's supposed to be conservative. And here you thought judges, especially judges appointed to the Supreme Court or high-level appellate judges for life, were supposed to be scrupulously nonpartisan. Not really. Oh, also, by the way, in the alternate universe, Nevada Assemblyman, that's their state legislature, a guy named Jim Wheeler, came under a lot of fire this week after a YouTube video surfaced in which he told a Republican gathering he would vote to allow slavery if that's what his constituents wanted him to do. That's good constituent service. Wheeler, of course, is an old white dude. He also added, after the inevitable outcry over this, for some liberal reason, added,
these people are too stupid to believe.
Yeah. Walking brain stems, I think, is the technical term. But he did afterwards, after all the outcry, sincerely apologized if his comments were taken with offense by anyone.
Oh, my God.
So,
I probably shouldn't be laughing at how terrible that is, but, you know, that really is so terrible. You could almost believe it was made up.
I'm just wondering how the Republican Minority Outreach Program is coming along these days.
I know.
And by the way, I've always thought, especially when it comes to the Tea Party, that that's really the problem that the writers in the Onion faced is how do you
make fun of people who make fun of themselves almost?
Yeah, it's like, you know, if satire is the, you know, taking absurd things to their logical extreme, it's already being done. But
right.
Never say it can't get worse, because worse will be up to the challenge.
Yeah.
That's right. And as an example, further revelations this week regarding the NSA.
Yes, the Washington Post this week cited documents, more documents that they obtained from whistleblower Edward Snowden, that the NSA has been hacking into the fiber optic cables that carry data between the big international data centers owned by big tech companies, including Google and Yahoo. So a lot of these companies are offering cloud computing services, and we've all been marketed those services about how if you store your data up in the cloud, in the web, that it'll be safe, it'll be secure, it'll be private, no one else will have access to it, and that in case of a disaster in your area, that your data will still be recoverable. Well, what they're not telling you is that your data, if it goes up into the cloud, will also be recovered automatically by the NSA. It will be dumped into a huge database where NSA analysts can sift through it at will, and it will be held there for years, possibly a decade or more. Cloud service providers, what a lot of people don't know is once you put your data up into the cloud, it's not stored in a data center near you. It's sent either across the country or it's sent across an international border. And there are reasons for that. One of the reasons for that is the disaster recovery guarantee that they give you. If it's stored in a local data center, then it's much more likely to be wiped out in case of a natural disaster in your region. So it's much more likely for your data to be sent if not across state boundaries, halfway across the country, or much more likely to be sent internationally, where it then falls under the NSA's purview. They can grab it without needing any kind of a warrant, and they almost feel obliged to grab data that is sent across international borders. And that, in fact, we're finding out from Congress interviewing all of these NSA officials that the NSA feels that if they don't grab data that's sent across international borders, they're not simply doing their job.
And certainly grabbing a lot of data from within the U.S. borders also.
Yes.
But what about if there's a natural disaster in this place where the data is actually being held?
Well, that's the thing. These cloud computing companies say that they have redundancy built into their system. So your data could also be on the East Coast. It could be in France. It could also be a copy of it. Could also be over in Japan. You just don't know where it's at.
So you won't get charged with one conspiracy to commit terror act. You'll be charged with four.
No, not necessarily. But, data redundancy and the fact that your data could be in multiple places at one time is highly probable. Not just possible, but highly probable.
Well, I believe the NSA is working on rebranding themselves as the Department of Data Redundancy.
Yeah. And by the way, it's fine to piss off like 35 heads of state, including most of our major allies, but don't piss off Google.
Yeah. Google and Yahoo didn't know that this was being done, that their fiber optic cables were being hacked by the NSA, and they're pretty angry about it, and for good reason.
All right. Moves us on then to international and developments in Syria.
Yeah, some good news out of Syria for once. International UN inspectors have announced that they've completed verification of Syria's chemical weapons arsenal at 21 different sites, but that there are two sites still outstanding, and that's because those two sites are either in rebel hands, or they're inaccessible because the territory where the main highways or the main thoroughfares to get to those two sites are in rebel hands, and the rebels have not provided assurances to the UN that they will let inspectors through. So clearly there's some work there that that the US government and that the Turkish government and Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and the other countries that are supporting the rebels could be doing to speed this along. The Syrian government has been in compliance, but the Syrian rebels are not.
I thought it was the rebels that were the good guys in this. That's what I keep seeing on the evening news.
Well, yeah, that's what we see on the evening news. But when you're talking about a force that isn't homogenous, that isn't under the control of the Free Syrian Army, it can be difficult to get compliance from a group that's aligned to al-Qaeda to allow you to let your UN inspectors through.
All right. Well, with that, we have events.
Yeah, several events coming up today, and unfortunately, the weather is not especially cooperating. A couple of fundraisers at 2 o'clock. The Tenants Union of Washington is urging you to make a strike for renters' rights. They're doing a fundraising bowl-a-thon, which is always a lot of fun, and it's at West Seattle Bowl because, you know, there's only a couple bowling alleys left in Seattle that haven't been torn down for condos, West Seattle Bowl being one of them. It's at 4505 39th Avenue Southwest, of course, in West Seattle at 2 o'clock for the Tenants Union of Washington. And then tonight from 5:30 to 8:30, the Western Washington Fellowship of Reconciliation is having a fun and fundraising auction. That's at Woodland Park Presbyterian Church in Finney Ridge, 225 North 70th. Don't usually do campaign events, but it's going to be kind of hard to miss this one. So just because you might drive by five or six of them and wonder what's going on, the Shama Sawant campaign for city council is doing over 100 different neighborhood rallies throughout the day today and tomorrow. And those folks are going to get wet for their candidate. Check votesawant.org for times and locations, and it'll end with a major rally, larger rally at 14th and Jackson at 4 o'clock tomorrow. Tuesday, of course, is the deadline to vote. Get your ballots in by then. Particularly, plug here for the Sawant campaign and the Sue Peters campaign, two cases where grassroots candidates are running against bad opponents have a really good chance of winning. So definitely get out to vote regardless on that. And then maybe those two places are like the places to be on Tuesday night for the victory parties, hopefully. And then on a Friday, November 8th at 7 o'clock, the film Ghosts of Jeju, which is a great documentary about the anti-nuclear efforts at Jeju Island on South Korea, where they're trying to put in a nuclear facility. That film will be shown as part of Wallingford Meaningful Movies, which, of course, goes every Friday night. This coming Friday, the 8th, they'll have that one with the filmmaker, a guy named Regis Tremblay. That's at Keystone Church, 5019 Keystone Place North in beautiful, not quite downtown Wallingford.
Yeah, and one more event today, down at the Seattle Central Library, they will have assistance for folks who are trying to use the state healthcare website to sign up under the Affordable Care Act for insurance. That will be from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's a free event. It's today at the downtown Central Library.
All right.
Well, free if you don't count the fact that, you know, Obamacare costs 10 times as much as what you had before.
I saw
it on Fox.
No, actually, that's kind of interesting. That was big in the news this week, but the number of people who have had to switch who have been terminated and had to switch to new insurance under the Affordable Care Act is really only about 3% of the U.S. population. So I find it interesting that the media is spending all this time to talk about such a small number of people.
And people have to switch because they've been discontinued by their policies or kicked off because they're sick. Under the old law was at a much higher rate than that.
Yes.
But the media's focus traditionally is on about 3% if you know, celebrities and people in D.C.
Right.
I think it's a 0.3%.
Kittens and dogs.
Yeah.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both of the state. Where do people find you at the state?
www.eatthestate.org. And speaking of the election, our election recommendations are up. So is the article on the mayoral race and the conundrum about that with two candidates who are both very good on some things and very bad on others. So check that out. Again, www.eatthestate.org.